Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We got a fun one today. We haven't done a mailbag since August, so we're looking forward to doing that. We had users submit on Reddit, upvote. Danny was the curator, so if you don't get your question listened to, you can complain to him about it. And then also, I just got back. We're recording pretty late at night. Got back from Sacramento for the opener with Kings Spurs. Spurs won again in that one. So I think I'll probably start, Danny, talking a little bit about that game. I don't want to get into the game itself too much, but just what some of my observations were, and you're going to be there too on Saturday, so I guess we can, if we can, kind of compare notes on what we think of the arena after that.
Sure. And yeah, I watched a little bit of this game. I cracked up because I flipped it back. There was a break in Clippers Blazers, and Kawhi had two steals in like 15 seconds on Ben McLemore, and then I remembered, oh yeah, that's just Kawhi being a monster like he was on the opening night.
Yeah, Sam Amick and I were talking in the bowels of the arena afterwards, and he likened Kawhi Leonard to just like a Dementor from Harry Potter. He just stole Ben McLemore's soul. Ben McLemore was having a nice little game, and then that was it for him. Jaeger had to just take him out, and he never came back in again.
Well, and I mean, he just took the ball from him. It wasn't even like he just grabbed it away. You don't really see that.
Yeah, it was two just like pick six rip ups like at midcourt in a row. It was really, and Kawhi was just unbelievable again tonight. And Greg Popovich was once again effusive in his praise of him in the post game, and just what he's able to do. He just gets, the guy gets a good shot like 90% of the time. He goes one on one, which is really, really impressive, because a lot of guys just can't do that. He shoulders the guy off. He takes a mid-ranger that looks like it's contested, but he's totally within his comfort zone. He knows how to deal with that contest, and he just has been awesome. And then defensively, I mean, he had, especially during this run that the Spurs had to go from 9 down to up by about 10, he really was ridiculous defensively in that as well. I think for the Spurs, though, the biggest thing to me was just, again, Tony Parker and Pau Gasol. Pau Gasol did not finish in crunch time of this game. And Greg Popovich was asked after the game how he sees Gasol fitting in so far. And here's what he had to say.
It's still early in Pau's time here, but how do you see him fitting and kind of...
He's trying to feel his way defensively more than anything, trying to figure out what we're doing and what he's responsible for.
And so, yeah, I agree with him that Gasol wasn't that good. And then Dwayne Dedman was unbelievable. He's looked really good in both of these games. His hands look much better. He's actually catching passes on the pick and roll. He had this one play where he forced Aaron Afalo to pass on a drive, and then Kosta Koufos came in and looked like he was going to have a monster dunk, and Dedman materialized out of nowhere to block it, really adding that athletic, mobile shot blocker. And you could just tell, too, how happy he was. And I don't think he's really like that used to being interviewed after games, because I asked him, you know, kind of, how do you feel about, like, you didn't even get a qualifying offer from Orlando, and now you're closing games for this awesome team. And he was, oh, you know, I'm happy with where I'm at, blah, blah, blah. Didn't really have that much to add on that, but it was really a pretty, maybe it was a bad question, but it was pretty remarkable for him. And then Gasol was gracious as always, but you could tell a little bit that I don't know whether it rankled him that he wasn't getting as many touches or shots, or that he was just realized that he wasn't playing that well. And I would imagine you guys can listen to the audio for yourself and decide for yourself. I'll just give you the raw goods on that. A couple of questions here for Pau on how he's fitting in so far.
This early in your transition to the Spurs, are you still learning what exactly they want, offense and defense? Is that still a process that you're going through?
A little bit. I was just trying to adjust as quickly as possible, try to understand what's asked of me at all times, kind of thing, and at the same time trying to play my game and be myself, but being patient too, and doing as much as I can at this point. But I understand that I'm one of the new guys, and I just try to fit in as best as possible.
We knew when you came here what the roster looked like. That's obviously, you had a lot to do with you coming, but at the same time, it's good for most of your career being featured pretty consistently offensively.
That's correct.
Is that part an adjustment? Especially, I mean, you're coming off the summer where what you guys did.
Top scorer in the Olympics.
Nice. So.
I mean, it's every team is a little different, and I know this team offensively has plenty of weapons and has two go-to guys on the Marcus and Kawhi. So you just got to find your opportunities. but yeah, it's a part of the adjustment. Yeah. And but again, it's a long season, and we'll see how every game goes, and just try to do the best I can on both ends of the floor. I have to be better defensively to give the first unit a little more strength defensively, and you know, since I'm not going to be carrying as much load offensively as I'm used to.
I mean, I will say this about Pop. Like, the guy is a badass. And whether it's because, like, nobody else would have had the balls to do this. The Bulls should have been doing this, not having him close some games. And until the writing was on the wall and they knew he wasn't coming back and they weren't going to make the playoffs, they closed games with Cristiano Felicio at the end of the game. But if they had been closing with Noah, this playing Gasol and Noah together, all this stuff, maybe things could have been totally different in Chicago. But they lured Gasol there with promises, I think, you know, the circumstantial evidence will show that. But Pop is like, look, you know, if you're not playing well, you're not going to play. And Pau has been, you know, in negative double digits in both of these games here.
And the Spurs have expectations now, you know, like they certainly had them before, but now they're kind of seeing this a little bit differently. And Dedmon, what excites me about him on this team is that he kind of fits a big man archetype that they haven't had recently. You know, they've had a lot of different types of guys. They had, you know, Boban, they had Tim Duncan, of course, for years, and just a lot of different guys. And that really athletic kind of but more stout guy has been one of the missing pieces, and it always seemed like it would make sense in the Spurs defensive schemes.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we should talk about Tony Parker a little bit too. He was negative 12, 0 for 6 from the field. He really just has not embraced the three-pointer enough. He's okay shooting corner threes, but just above the break, he's never really felt comfortable, never gotten the type of volume that they need. And when they really start going against good defenses that are locked in, like Oklahoma City, you remember how hard it was for them to score against Oklahoma City. Big part of why they lost that series is because Patty Mills couldn't hit a shot. But Mills at least will space out to three, and all their bench guys really were like, you know, plus 19, plus 20, plus 18. And then the only guy among the starters who was in the positive was Kawhi Leonard. Everyone else was pretty low. So for the Kings, I thought that DeMarcus Cousins looked amazing, and then he tweaked an ankle early in the third quarter. And while he continued shooting and scoring, he wasn't as effective. He still ended up with 37 points on 29 shooting possessions and 16 rebounds in this one. But the Kings overall only had 6 offensive rebounds. The Spurs, we thought maybe that with Gasol, with David Lee, those guys aren't great defensive rebounders. They might be a little weak there, but they have dominated their own defensive glass in these first two games. Willie Cauley-Stein continues to look bad. I was struck by the fact that he gets his hands on a lot of rebounds and just doesn't have the hands to actually bring it in. It was surprising because he was like an all-state wide receiver in football in high school. And the Garrett Temple experiment as the backup point guard did not go particularly well. He was negative 9 in his 12 minutes, and Ty Lawson had to play 36 minutes. He still looks good. He had 9 assists. He's throwing some great full court dimes, especially in the first half when the Spurs were probably hitting the offensive glass a little too hard, and then Gasol and Aldridge, who are pretty slow in transition, weren't getting back. The Kings were killing them in transition. And they probably had like all 14 of their fast break points in the first half. So it was really a dispiriting performance for the Kings bench. Also, Omri Caspi didn't play at all in this game. It said, and he was listed as DNP coach's decision. And maybe he's coming back still from that hip injury that he had some problems with. But he wasn't listed on the injury report. So that's a lot. Matt Barnes well ahead of him in the rotation. And actually, their best units in this game actually were with Kostakoufos and Cousins together. Kufos still has a nice pick and roll chemistry with Lawson.
Yeah, and they played together in Denver. And Lawson, to me, what's been really nice about it is that he also can slide into a smaller role in terms of minutes, you know, when they get Collison back and they can get closer. Something that had been a concern for both of us with Sacramento was getting 48 minutes of quality primary ball handling time. And they're going to be a lot closer to that if Lawson can play at least 20 minutes a game than at least I expected.
Yeah, the problem with Lawson is he is very reluctant to shoot jumpers right now. He took one wide open three that wasn't close. He had one jump shot, but really his scoring is passing is still there. His quickness is still there to some degree. But his scoring, he really has not been looking to do that at all. And I don't know that he can do that at all. And finally, the Spurs started figuring that out and doubling off of him on Cousins post-ups. Tony Parker got a key steal late on that. That's probably enough on Spurs Kings, unless there's anyone else that you were particularly curious about from that you want to ask me about.
I just wanted to note that Caspi played 8 minutes in their opener against the Suns. So I don't know if that's an indication. And that game had a lot of garbage time too. So the way that they handled that. So maybe they are still working him slowly.
Yeah. And this is a little bit of a dispiriting loss for the Kings, but they played well. Their starters played well. And I think maybe if Cousins hadn't tweaked that ankle, that maybe they could have been competitive down the end. Oh, David Lee, we got to talk about too. He's been fantastic in these first couple of games. He was 5 out of 6 from the field, playing with two bigs, mostly with Dedmon. They did have the Lee Gasol front court for a brief time period.
I saw that stretch and was just sitting there going, make him defend in space. And I realized I didn't need to specify the him in that. It's just like both of those guys just run high inside.
Well, that was when they had Garrett Temple in. So,
yep.
And Rudy Gay might be able to get a mid-range jumper off of pick and roll, but he's not going to hit the roll man in a way that's going to put pressure on your big defender in the pick and roll either. And Rudy definitely looks, less athletic. I mean, just some of his forays to the rim where he used to just cock it back and guys would get out of the way, like he was getting blocked or missing it, or, he would get fouled, but it doesn't have the same elevation that he used to, for sure.
Ready to move on to the mailbag?
Yes, absolutely. This is going to be fun. You want to pick the first one out here?
Well, the first one is addressed to me, so I guess I can ask it and then answer it.
Why don't I ask it then?
Okay.
I will pretend to be the...
It was one thing I'll note at the beginning is it was funny to me how many of the questions were addressed to me specifically. I don't really know why that was, but I welcome it.
Maybe you're more of a Reddit presence than I am. You're considered...
That is true. I am.
Yeah. Because, actually, I posted this and I didn't actually ever sign back into the thread because I was doing something else this morning. So you were kind enough to curate these questions for us. And then I threw you under the bus and get yelled at
by a Magic fan who thought I was too critical of their front court. But I stand by it. You can read the Reddit.
What just in the game last night?
Yeah, basically somebody had talked. I just intermixed myself.
Scored 74 points in the paint.
Yeah, and they were talking so somebody had criticized it that they were overstuffed. And I didn't even get into this whole thing about how even though they didn't have Vooch, they still played Aaron Gordon out of position for the whole thing and then played Jeff Green as the backup four. So that tirade is for another day. I want to see the Magic a couple more times before let's say our first 15 and 60 on the East.
Yeah. All right. So here's the question. This is from Zigzag Zill. Danny, you stated on a podcast before that you thought OKC clearly would have won the 2016 finals if they had beaten Golden State. Any reason why, and does Nate agree?
That overstates my position a little bit. I believed that they would be the favorites and that they would win. Clearly is a strong word, considering especially how well LeBron and Kyrie ended up playing in that series. But Oklahoma City, first of all, their best player wasn't playing at 70-80%, and that certainly would help. And the way that Cleveland was kind of defending, they didn't have anybody for Russ, and they couldn't have handled that kind of situation very well. But also just the nature of the threats of last year's OKC team with Ibaka and Durant, there isn't really as clear a place to put LeBron. And finally, you and I were both there in Oklahoma City for games 3 and 4 of the Western Conference Finals. And those were, in my opinion, the two best games I'd seen the team play since the Spurs blowing the doors off the Heat at the end of the 2014 Finals. So when you see a team do that to a dangerous squad, you think, okay, there's something special here. And I don't think Cleveland had a counter to that, but Oklahoma City, they still could have had the breakdowns in crunch time, which ended up costing them the series. But I think they would have just, they had the right horses. And Andre Iguodala basically said the same thing too, which was funny.
I think it would have been a toss up. Cleveland would have had home court, which I think was pretty big for Oklahoma City. I might have made Cleveland slight favorites. I mean, you think about the way those teams would have matched up. I think Oklahoma City's rim protection would have been something that would have been a problem I guess you'd look at it one of the two ways. Maybe that it wouldn't have been as much of a problem for Cleveland because LeBron and Kyrie are great finishers, or you could say that those are the things that they do best, and so you can counter their strengths. I happen to probably go to the latter too, because Oklahoma City really shut down both the Spurs and the Warriors at the rim. I think that Cleveland would have been able to help neutralize Oklahoma City's offensive rebounding. But you're right. I think that Russell Westbrook really is someone that nobody on Cleveland could have matched up with successfully. And Kyrie, I guess they would have had to put J.R. Smith on him and then just...
Well, and because Shumpert had a bad series too, so it's not like, and they weren't really willing to put Shumpert in. Like, that would have been the 2015 solution, but that didn't happen last year.
Yeah, so I would have made Cleveland, just based on the basis of home court, maybe a slight favorite. Probably going into the series, I might have said maybe Oklahoma City was a slight favorite, but I think that just the matchups and also just LeBron's ability to control the game would have been pretty big, as someone who just had more experience than those Oklahoma City guys did. All right, what do we got next here?
So next question is from Umari USVI. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that.
Yeah, you know, that's actually one downside of doing Reddit is like these names are pretty ridiculous.
I think that's part of the joy of it. So the question is, what are your
top... It has to at least be like pronounceable for us though. Like if you have underscores or like, like at least I'm sure they're all sort of like plays on something or another. But it's...
Ours are our names because we're boring. What are your top five league pass teams to watch this season and why?
All right, so these are the ones that I came up with as potential candidates. Like, people who listen to these mailbags know that I kind of like to think this way and say who I think the possibilities are and then narrow it down. Warriors, Nuggets, Wolves, Sixers when Simmons comes back, Blazers, Spurs, and Jazz. Anyone that you would add to that list?
The Rockets are Rockets made my top five.
Okay, yeah, I left them out just because I think their defense is just going to be comedy, it seems like. So
and I had the Clippers in my also consider.
Yeah, I guess it's Zach Lowe was saying this the other day too, that it's he actually said it to JJ Redick on Redick's podcast, that we just know so much what those guys are that it's just like because I mean, to me, there's two factors. It's how exciting is the basketball that you're playing? How much do I, and then also just, I want to learn more by watching your team, a team that I'm interested in. That's the appeal of the Nuggets. I think they're going to play up tempo, especially at home. They have all these young guys that I like, and I just want to see kind of how they're going to turn out. And it's the same principle with the Wolves.
Well, you didn't see the majesty that was their bench unit of Raymond Felton, Austin Rivers, Jamal Crawford, Wes Johnson.
You know how I feel. Like, I'm not one of these like, oh, it's entertaining because you have all these ridiculous guys on it. Like,
it was a blast.
Like, how? Why? Just because they like do a bunch of weird stuff and take bad shots? Like, I don't want to watch shitty basketball. I'm sorry. Like, that doesn't bring me joy.
It's a very different... I actually enjoyed it from an intellectual perspective because it's a bench philosophy that if, you know, most teams don't really have much in terms of the way of defense, or, you know, Portland's, depending on how they structure the rotation, they don't have a ton of offensive guys there. You know, they have more of the Vonleh types. And so they just had a lot of guys who can create their own offense, and they were running a lot. Spates hit a few threes. And so, yeah, it's different. I mean, I enjoy the ridiculous more than you do. That's something, you know, like I've watched teams both of extremely like bad varieties and other things more. But so do you want to go through your five, or do you want me to do my five and then you can react to it?
Oh, quick question on that Clippers Portland game. Did they stagger Griffin and Paul or no?
No, I didn't see much of that, no, which was a little bit disappointing. But there were minutes, because of the way everything worked out, where Spates played with Griffin, and I thought that worked reasonably well offensively because it had more force.
That is a good offensive company.
Yeah, defense, meh. But
okay, all right. Well, so the Warriors got to be in there, obviously.
Yeah, they're my one.
Wolves have got to be in there.
They're my two.
Those are probably the only two that I'd say are like absolutely have to be in there. And the six are just Simmons and Embiid are just, just as because he's a Chicago guy and I like his low post moves, I actually find Okafor more enjoyable than a lot of people do. Saric, I think, is nice.
Sergio Rodriguez was enthralling on an opening night.
Yeah, I mean, like, now if they're like really bad, I mean, maybe like some of these teams too, it's like, yes, but only if they're at home. You know, like the Sixers are just never going to win a road game and they're just going to get killed. So it's like, and the crowd really loves Embiid and likes these young guys too. I'm sure they'll be into Simmons also. So like, maybe the Sixers at home, are we allowed to just say that? I mean,
mine was the Sixers when Embiid is in for now, and then when Simmons is in eventually.
Yeah, so I think the Blazers really just are an underrated team, and especially just Dame and CJ are really good. I really love the stuff that Terry Stotts runs. I like the fact that they're playing small now with Aminu at the four. Their centers are a little frustrating. I like Ed Davis. I don't really care for Plumlee's game from an aesthetic standpoint.
You would have lots of thoughts about his game tonight.
Yeah, but Dame is fantastic. He's one of my favorite players to watch in the league, and there's just so much spacing on the floor. Those guys can heat up at any time. So can CJ. So I think the Blazers would be in there for me too.
I approach the list from the idea of where they're going to be at the start of the year, because the other two teams. So that you mentioned the Sixers, they're my fourth. So my fifth is the Rockets, and my third is the Jazz. And the reason for that is that they're both teams that I'm interested in at the start of the year to see how their stuff fits together. And over the course, you know, let's say by February, depending on how it works out, both teams could be substantially further down the list, because by that point they should have figured a lot of this out. But Utah has a lot of new additions. I'm excited to see how they function without Gordon Hayward during this time, and then once they bring him back in. And then with the Rockets, it's just, I called the Funhouse Mirror was the Rockets Lakers game. You get all that, James Harden really unleashing him in a different way than has happened before. I'm a big Clint Capella guy, and also the idea that D'Antoni is so good at getting the most out of kind of like weird bench players, and so Decker and McDaniels, those kind of guys I'm always interested in. So, and Eric Gordon's a fun reclamation project. He did a nice job in their first game, and so those are the ones to me. I love the Blazers, but the reason why they didn't make it for now is that they have so little uncertainty.
Why aren't we considering the Cavs? LeBron and Kyrie on the surface are two of the they shoot a lot of threes. Those are two of the most awesome individual players in the league.
I watch them a lot because I love watching LeBron. Yeah. But
yeah. They probably have less uncertainty than like any team in the league. That's one reason. Like exactly. they're low on those rankings.
And the Cavs are a great team for people who watch League Pass kind of the way I do, where when somebody starts saying, oh, LeBron's going off, or oh, Kyrie's going off, then you could switch to it. You know, like you can have it as a secondary game or even a tertiary game, but just be ready to jump to it. Then you don't have to watch it, especially because they're just better than most of the teams they play. And so it's not like the Warriors where you have to that piece of trying to figure out how this is all going to work. You know, with Cleveland, it's basically the same dudes.
I also just don't really care for the way Cleveland plays offense aesthetically. Even if they do have a lot of shooting, it's still, all right, we're going to run a pick and roll, and this guy is just going to make a play, and then we'll throw it to a shooter. You know, there's just a lot of that kind of stuff. And credit to LeBron and Kyrie that they are good enough to still score very effectively, even without a ton of creativity and ball movement on offense. But yeah, that's one reason for me too. But the biggest reason is just the lack of curiosity factor. Like they are just, you know, we know exactly what they are, I feel. So yeah, I think I would round mine out. I'll put the Nuggets in there. So Warriors, Nuggets, Wolves, Blazers, and then I'd make the Jazz my last one. No love for the Spurs at all?
I mean, after seeing them on Tuesday, they definitely warranted more consideration. But again, we know a lot of what they're doing kind of 1-4, and the Powell integration just isn't something that intrigues me that much.
Yeah. I mean, Kawhi is really
incredible.
Getting up there for me of one of the guys that you just got to love watching. And Deadman adds a nice little element as well of athleticism that they haven't had. But yeah, Lee and Gasol, like they're, and maybe the fact that they'll be able to integrate those guys and not get killed, that's interesting to me. But yeah, it's they're probably in the top 10 for me, but not in the top 5.
Yeah, that's certainly fair.
All right, NBA Jedi. All right, that's a good name. How many consecutive NBA finals will LeBron end up making? He's at 6 and counting right now.
I feel like I'm going to say the mode, so the most frequent outcome, if you were to just break those out, would be 8. 7, 8, 9 are all reasonable, but I'm going to go with they make 2 more in a row and then somebody overtakes them.
Yeah, I would say so as well, just because LeBron, 34, he's got to start slowing down at that point. And I don't... Kevin Love as well. He's already had his prime years. He'll be 30 at that point. And Kyrie, I don't know that I trust him enough. And I think he's also someone who's probably, this might be the best season of his career coming up right now at like 25. I think he's one of those guys who's going to peak earlier I don't think that he has like the greatest fitness regimen from like a body composition standpoint, and that he's also that actually should be from a body composition standpoint, that should be one of the singles on my album.
Yep.
By the way,
that was a fun little riff stretch.
Oh god, yeah. In any event, yeah, I think 8 is definitely I think what it is, and if only I might have gotten 7, but just because there's still nobody up and coming in the East. I mean, you could say maybe Boston if they get another star, I might favor over them next year. here. But yeah, I think it's pretty unlikely. This is let's do this one next, which is kind of along the same lines here. Scroll down for this one. Who will be, this is from with two N's, who will be the worst team in 3 years?
Sacramento Kings. Because not only...
So what's 3 years? That's 2018-19, right?
I would say 3 years is 2019-20.
I think of it as
either
two
way,
more years and then the third year is the
either way, years. It's the Kings, because DeMarcus Cousins will have been a free agent by that point. They don't have a ton of cap flexibility, and a lot of their players, like their best players, will have already hit unrestricted free agency by that point. So, you know, and it's a small market.
Yeah, they don't have any good young players that they've drafted.
And they're already losing at least one, probably two draft picks during that time as well, because the 2019 first will be after the time frame you specified. But yeah, that's why that trade was amazing.
Scal was inactive tonight. He's really the only one of their young guys that I like at all. That doesn't bode that well, though they do have a ton of bigs. So others that I would say receiving votes here, I'm not sure I'm going to say the Kings. I have my list. I think the Mavericks could be horrendous. I mean, maybe with Carlisle they won't be, and they have some space. But once Dirk's gone, I mean, they don't really have any young talent on this team. And if they get a draft pick in the next 2 years, those guys won't be any good. They're not going to get a good draft pick this year. Here's a sneaky one for you. I don't think that'd be the worst. How about the Oklahoma City Thunder?
Yeah, that's a possibility, but they also, I feel like if they go down that road, they still have Steven Adams, though. I mean, Steven Adams is quite good and will be better then.
Yeah, Oladipo, you presume there's no way that they're going to lose him.
Well, and I would be shocked if they lost Russ without getting assets in return. So then those players, they might need to come along, but they'll have talent. They're not going to be bereft like the Kings might be.
Yeah, the reason we're even saying this to begin with is because Russell Westbrook only kicked the can down the road a year. He'll be an unrestricted free agent at 29. And, you know, we'll see how this year goes for them, too. If they aren't that good this year, then maybe they could decide to move on from him too, or he might want to move on.
What about the Knicks?
Oh, they have KP.
Yeah, they'll have Porzingis, but I mean, they're going to have a ton of money
tied
up.
$30 million in space this offseason. They'll probably be able to get someone good. Carmelo is like, maybe they either trade him or he'll still be okay enough.
Hopefully by then.
If you have the Porzingis that we think that he's going to be, then you're not the worst team in the league. So
that's true.
Another one, the New Orleans Pelicans, if they were to be forced to trade Anthony Davis, that would be around the time where that might happen. And I have little faith in their ability, even with him turning into even more of a monster, if that happens.
I've got one for you.
Yeah.
The Seattle Sonics.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's expansion, I mean, there'll probably be another team too. Hopefully, I really hope it's the Seattle Sonics and then the Vancouver Grizzlies, and then they force Memphis to change their name. Memphis can go back to the Sounds, which would be sweet. Then they could have those jerseys too. And Memphis, of course,
are welcome on my corner on this point. That is, I've been harping on that for like a year now. But yeah, the Memphis Sounds, not only does it fit, but their uniforms are beautiful.
Yeah. But so Memphis, I mean, Marc Gasol will be 34. Mike Conley will be probably traded by, I mean, both those guys could be traded by then. Like this is the last-ish gasp. Chandler Parsons will be finishing up his contract. He'll be 30 and has had all these health issues. Zach Randolph and Tony Allen will be gone by then. You have to imagine they don't really have any young prospects of note. Their draft picks even are committed. They're not going to have a draft pick this year. And then they're going to want to, that pick that they owe to the Celtics from Jeff Green is like pretty highly protected. So if they're not going to be good, you know, they're going to say, all right, we got to trade all these guys and tank to make sure we keep this protected pick, which is like, you know, 8-6-4 or something like that.
I got one more. Indiana if Paul George leaves.
Yeah, that's a possibility. But with the new extension rules, I think that is perhaps less likely. Brooklyn still.
That's sad.
I mean, how are they going to get better? They don't have a draft pick until 2019 anyway.
Yeah. I'm just sad. I agree with you, but
I mean, maybe like they somehow get to 30 wins this year and they get a free agent or two, or I mean, maybe if they just could like fill in with like a decent enough power forward and then like one more wing guy and LeVert and Hollis Jefferson, who didn't even close the game last night against the Celtics, by the way. You know, maybe McCullough can become something, but yeah, I mean, are you high at any of those guys to like get you out of the bottom 30 wins. And then here's another one too for you, the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, if they don't have Jimmy Butler at that point, I think Butler's good enough to kind of prop them up to make them not the worst team in the league, but they could be in the mix.
But by then, Butler, 3 years from now, Butler's contract will be over. He'll be older. I wrote in the Insider 5-on-5 on the Bulls that I did is, all right, if they aren't good this year and Wade and Rondo move on, or, you know, then you've just got Butler and you got nothing else. And at that point, maybe it's just time for the total rebuild.
Trade him to the Celtics.
If Nikola Mirotic isn't looking like a good starting power forward, which I think is, you know, he hasn't turned that corner yet. He's going to be a restricted free agent. There's a lot of that. So I think that if they move on from Butler, they could be real bad for a while because I don't like really any of their young talent.
But then they're going to sign Stephen Curry as a free agent, so they're okay.
All right, what's next here?
Dylan C2. Is there a reason why so many teams seem to lock into a team and direction and try to win this year despite championship contenders, the most expensive contracts we've ever seen, and a very good draft class, presumably in 2017?
Yeah, so if you compare this year to 2014, the Wiggins, Embiid, Jabari Parker, Julius Randle draft that everyone was so excited about. Again, remember, by the way, don't go crazy about drafts a year ahead of time because sometimes it doesn't work out that way. I think there are a number of reasons. Number one is people worried about their jobs. That's Orlando. That's the Lakers, I think, for certain. Just feeling like, hey, we got to get better this year or we're going to get fired. You know, there's the Jim Buss timeline in LA. Rob Hennigan in Orlando is under a lot of pressure to make the playoffs. So that's there. Another factor is that just due to the low salary cap holds that a lot of young players in the 2012 draft had, that a lot of the space was basically used or lose it. I think teams like Detroit is one of those. Washington with Brad Beal is another one of those, where Portland with all their guys like Crab, another one of those. And so they felt like, hey, these low cap holds, if we don't use it now, then when we re-sign these guys, we're going to be over the cap anyway. So this is a one-time shopping spree. We better use it here. And Washington, I think, also another one of those teams that's under pressure to win now. And then also, I think it's just not getting it is another reason, not understanding the market dynamics. I think the feeling was, especially when there was a projection that the cap would be 107 the year after this one, and maybe it'll get up there still, we'll see. These kind of conditions are going to go on forever, because 2015, any contract that you signed was going to turn out to be a good one unless you're the New Orleans Pelicans, and just because the cap was so low. 2016, there's that feeling as well, but you have to remember that the market is so inflated, not only because this is the first year that these people are going to be on the market to get these kind of contracts, and so you're comparing them to guys that still have way smaller contracts. And then also you have to remember that the free agent class wasn't that good. And finally, that you have to look at it as sort of the amount of cap space that teams had over what they usually have this year was so large. And when you look at that compared to next year, we already looked at it, probably only 15 teams in the league are going to have max cap space this next year, as opposed to just about 26, 27 teams at least had the possibility of max cap space this year. So all of those things, I think people just didn't quite understand that well enough. And so those are all the factors that I see. Anything new you wanted to add there?
My main point is one that you alluded to but didn't make outright, which is ownership. I mean, really, when you look at teams that act impatiently, even though there are large incentives, ownership is the best explanation. The team you didn't mention is the Knicks. The Knicks really do align with that, you know, spending a lot to win now.
Yeah. And that's Phil Jackson too. You know, he's only got a year left now. So
right. So you can see that. I mean, and then you also had situations like the Bulls where it was just kind of weird opportunities presenting themselves piecemeal, and they chose, hey, that looked good. Hey, that looks good. And so you get into those kind of circumstances. And then a lot of it was, you know, use it or lose it. Charlotte, I mean, I think just with the way that they had, you know, just a weird amount of things. And so we'll see how their contracts work out. I'm not saying they were as bad as some of the other ones. But yeah, I mean, for a lot of teams I had in, you know, like writing off-season previews for every team for the Sporting News, a lot of them were, don't spend money poorly. And then almost all of them did. That's just the nature of the business. I knew it when I wrote it, but you want to preach caution because it's the right move, even if ownership ownership doesn't feel that.
How would you rank these young players if you were an expansion franchise and were allowed to choose one? D'Angelo Russell, Devin Booker, Kristaps Porzingis, Nikola Jokic, Miles Turner, Andrew Wiggins, Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons.
I'll go bottom to top. Bottom is Andrew Wiggins, just because he doesn't fill any of the key boxes yet. He probably will, but he doesn't yet, so that concerns me a little bit. Then Ben Simmons, he's proven it the least. I like him a lot, but we don't have the track record on him that we do with some of the other guys. Then Embiid, because if he can become what he could be, it's an insanely valuable thing in the league. Then Devin Booker, he could be a hybrid guard in a way that is a positive thing. I would have had him lower, except that he really impressed in Summer League and Team USA. For Nikola Jokic, he proved more than like a guy like Embiid has already, and he did it really well last year. 3, Miles Turner, more defensive potential, showed something offensively, both in the summer and an opening night. 2, D'Angelo Russell, because primary ball handlers are incredibly valuable in the league, and I like what he could do offensively. And 1 is Porzingis, because Porzingis could be legitimately special, even if the Knicks don't put him in that situation for a couple of years.
How much would it change your rankings if you knew for sure that Embiid would not suffer any more major injuries in his career?
He'd go to 3 or 2, maybe even 1.
Yeah. I mean, he is 22, so it's hard to say what his development is going to be from here on out. I'm lower on D'Angelo than you. I think Jokic actually might be on the bottom of my list, which seems insane for someone who played as well as he did last year.
And he's
but
young.
But here's the reason. Starting an expansion franchise, I'm just going for the absolute highest upside guy, and that's not Jokic to me. He's not going to be a dominating one-on-one scorer. He doesn't have the athleticism to be a lockdown defender. I think he can be decent, but I don't think he's even going to get to, you know, I mean, Marc Gasol is the example that you always hold up for an unathletic guy still being a really good defender, but that almost never happens. So Jokic just doesn't have the athletic explosion to me, despite some of his other skills being very effective. And I think he's someone who can get played off the floor like he did yesterday against Anthony Davis. So I he would be last for me. I think that the odds that he is the worst player out of those guys are very low. I think he'll be somewhat around the median for all those guys, but I'm going upside. My number one out of those guys, that is a really, not D'Angelo either. Again, I actually don't think that his upside is that high, because he just has a lot of work to do on defense, and he has a lot of work to do finishing at the rim and being efficient. And even
you don't think
passing.
He could be like, let's say, a less athletic version of what Lillard was last year? I mean, this year seems like he's doing better finishing at the rim, but like, I think last year's Lillard is a reasonable comp.
Yeah, well, so Lillard was probably maybe the 10th best guy in the league last year, between like 10 and 15, you would say. But Lillard is just so much more athletic than he is off the dribble. He is finishing at the rim, I think, better than Russell is ever going to finish at the rim. Like, Russell just doesn't have the explosion to just blow by guys. He also, I don't think he can get his shot off as well one-on-one as Lillard can. I think Russell could be very switchable once teams really decide, all right, well, this is what our strategy is going to be. He can operate in pick and roll, but he's not like some amazing vision guy. I mean, he has amazing vision, but the assist numbers haven't been there for him yet. Maybe they'll get there, but they haven't yet, and you start to wonder about that a little bit. So yeah, I would have him and Booker probably down there as well. So I would say Porzingis and Turner is a really tough call to me. I think that Turner, just with what he can do blocking shots and how hard he plays, that I know that he can be a center. I'm not sure about that with Porzingis. Yeah, that's a tough call for me. I probably would still go Porzingis just because he was better last year, but Turner definitely coming on. And then, Wiggins and Embiid are tough too. Wiggins could be really, really good. He still has do you agree with me that Wiggins has a lot of upside?
Oh, yeah, especially, of course.
Like, who has the biggest upside of anybody on this list? Regardless of their chances of actually getting there, who could be the best player? Probably Embiid and then Wiggins, I would say, right? And then maybe Simmons after them. And I would say those three guys are the highest upside.
Yeah, I would say it's those three guys and then Porzingis. Or Miles Turner, actually, because Miles Turner could be more of a two-way guy. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd probably say those three, then Miles.
Oh, man, this is a really, really hard question. I mean, I guess I would go with... Porzingis, just because he's like the most certain thing right now. Booker and Russell, I think, are just not athletic enough. I don't see either of those guys ever being the best player on a really good team, to be honest, just due to their athleticism and their defense. And Jokic, I already said, why it wouldn't be him. Embiid, if he were 20 and doing what he's doing right now, the answer would be him probably, but then there's also the injury issues as well. So it really probably comes down to Porzingis, Turner, Wiggins, and Simmons. And Simmons just has so much upside too. If he could learn to shoot, we don't know if that's gonna happen. It's really amazing, and I'm sorry I'm rambling on and struggling with this question. I guess I would go with Porzingis, but I don't feel good about that. I think it's really tough between any like those top five guys for me.
Yeah, and as somebody who had Turner over Porzingis in the pre-draft stuff when they both went out, like I'm seeing more now why I felt that way. I mean, I always did. Like, I just saw Turner's potential to be a real positive on both ends of the floor as something, and Porzingis' passing is something we just didn't see when he was at Sevilla. But Turner could end up being that kind of a guy. And, you know, Embiid could too. You know, like, we'll have to see it with some time with all those guys. And I'm so excited about the big man. And I wanted to go briefly into the question that was actually a reply to that question, which was asking me, keep an eye on the upcoming drafts. Is there anybody in the next upcoming draft classes that you put in with those guys? And the answer is no, because guys like Markelle Fultz haven't proven it even in college yet. And that's a whole different level. And so Fultz, if he has the year that I expect, certainly he could join this group. I mean, he's a very special guy. His size, his vision, his competitiveness. But when all a guy's done is played in like high school and AAU stuff, I can't have him make this list. These guys all have way better pedigrees than that.
Yeah, even the class below there too has some interesting guys. And like Wendell Carter, I think, is going to be really good. I think of him as like maybe like a better shooting Derek Favors. DeAndre Ayton obviously has incredible physical tools, although I'm not sure that his execution or like passion for the game are necessarily gonna get there.
Trevon, but
yeah, all the guys, there are definitely, I think that there are some guys in that 2018 potential draft that might even have more upside than these 2017 guys, especially with Harry Giles again having another knee surgery now and just the questions about him. Although I think this 2017 draft class looks like really deep to me, but I haven't seen enough of those guys to really comment quite yet. All right, where are we going now?
I think this ties in with that question. It's from Fazzy Bear 23. Based on some of the high school prospects you guys have seen and some of the players recently drafted, what positions in the NBA do you think will be relatively deep or thin in, let's say, 4 to 6 years?
Wings. That's always what it is. Just enough guys with athleticism. I mean, you just look at the U.S. versus all the other teams in the world. They don't have any wings, and that's why we win these tournaments, because we have great wings. But guys with size and skill and athleticism on the wing, you're always going to be looking for those. Every team in the league wants more 3-and-D guys. You're trying to play smaller. It's harder to do because there just aren't enough of those guys. So it's always going to be wings to me.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by the big men that are coming up and the idea of encouraging bigs to have a more diverse skill set, including shooting, is going to be great for the league in about 5 to 10 years. Wendell Carter is another guy. You brought him up. Ayton, if he can kind of get himself together. Like, there are a lot of guys. Like, we kept on seeing big guys. Even Chal Merrill could shoot a little bit. And so that's a nice thing with that. And also there's a contingent of guys that are legit primary ball handlers that are like 6'4", 6'5", which is really exciting, but they're probably still going to guard ones. So then that even...
You're thinking of Mohamed Bamba is who you were thinking of, wasn't it?
Well, Bamba had a little bit of a jump shot, but so did Merrill. I saw him again. I think I saw him again on one of the last days of the camp, and he shot a little bit. But yeah, Bamba's a little bit different.
Yeah, too skinny for my taste personally, but that's too esoteric for...
But the idea of those guys that can shoot, like Wendell Carter is a good example of this. Like, that's a really, for me, an encouraging development, and some of those guys have more guardy skill sets. But yeah, if we see the point guards squeeze the wings too, then that becomes a different thing. Like, if we can just see fewer 5'10", 6-foot point guards in the league, because you kind of, they're more exploitable. I mean, the great ones will always make it through, but that would even squeeze wings harder. But maybe that will lead to something I've wanted for years, which is just play those 6'4", 6'5", Markelle Fultz guys, just have them guard twos and put somebody else in to guard the ones.
Danisco 1979. With the cyclical nature of things, when and how do we see teams turn away from small ball? Number one, I don't know that basketball really is cyclical. I mean, not everything is. You know, the economy is cyclical, but I don't know that that like all systems are cyclical, and I'm not sure that basketball is either. I think we just continued to go towards more skill and more shooting. And the biggest thing that caused that was the rules change. And so it's one of two things that's going to have to happen. Either the rules change again, or bigs get better and they're just quicker and faster and can shoot more, can switch more. Because I think posting up with the way the rules are right now is just not going to be that effective for the best players on the best teams necessarily. And so like the teams that have really good big men, yeah, you'll leave those guys in. But if you just have, an Omer Asik type of center, then those guys aren't as good as just like an equivalent wing player. So you're just better off going small. And I think I think is something that is structural within the rules of the game right now, and something I don't see changing.
The days of just throwing the ball into a 7-foot guy and having him jostle for a position are not dead, but they're largely minimized because it's a lot easier to attack it now. However, I think that we are a couple of years away from a real renaissance of back to the basket players who have other positions. So players like Wiggins, like Shabazz Muhammad, and when you play with a center that can shoot, you can start to exploit some of those matchups. So you kind of have something that looks similar to the older lineups, but you do it more on switches and things like that. So I think we're going to see the guys that have good back to the basket games work. I just think it's not going to be centers as often.
Yeah, that's a good point there, and that you're just, it's more just having shooting on the floor. Some guys who can't shoot, then all right, now we're going to have bigs who can shoot instead, and we'll have this guy, Stanley Johnson, and it'll go post up for you instead. Those type of things. This is from, oh God, should we even, NXX, is that a B? BX?
It's a K.
Ah, okay.
Not
in excess. Okay. In XX. No, all right. Never mind. Which player set to enter restricted free agency next summer has the most to lose or gain based off their performance this year?
So for me, I took off the guys that are going to get paid no matter what. So somebody like Steven Adams, he's going to get his money. So I don't think there's a lot of variance there. Even if he got hurt, I think he'd be fine. And there are a lot of good options, but my preferred guy who I just think has the most variance is Ben McLemore, because there are still people that really like him and that, that they could talk themselves into a good contract. The analog is Harrison Barnes, but with a worse track record, because he has things that he can do well. He looked good tonight and he'll have those moments, but if he just really struggles again, then it could be like Dion Waiters, where you just see the market dry up, because it's like, why should we pay him instead of paying all the other guys?
Yeah, the list of guys, I agree with your criteria. The guys who were drafted in 2013 and are kind of have talent but haven't really put it together, aren't in the greatest situations. So Michael Carter Williams is one of those guys, right? If he plays well for the Bulls this year, maybe he even takes over the starting point guard for Rondo, or is really good as a backup and some team wants to bring him in as a lower end starter and pay him eight figures, or he just totally washes out and maybe he's like a lower end backup and he just languishes. I think Andre Roberson is one of those two. I don't think this is going to happen, but if he somehow could prove that he could shoot, or maybe just there'll be a team that says, hey, we're just going to play this guy at the four.
Like MCW. Four.
Yeah. And have him be a role man.
But MKG.
Yeah. Yeah. MKG is just light years ahead of Roberson in terms of his skill level offensively, with the dribbling and such.
And he's a maniac. Well, actually, they're both maniacs on the board, so that helps.
So he would be one. McLemore, I like that one. Tony Snell is another one too. I mean, if he plays well in Milwaukee, then maybe some team is like, hey, we'll bring him in to be our starting 2-3-and-D guy, or he just washes out and he's no one even looks at him as a rotation guy. He's gonna have plenty of chances. And then two Bulls, I thought also, Nikola Mirotic, signed only a 3-year deal that has him maybe under market. He's making about $6 million a year. If he starts, he could get $20 million a year. Ryan Anderson just got $20 million a year. I don't think the market will be that robust, but he could get high teens if he plays really well. Or, he could just be some backup power forward that you bring in to provide some shooting off the bench. He could get $8 million a year or $9 million a year. And Cristiano Felicio is another one, actually, for the Bulls, I think. Someone could really like him as an energy backup center, maybe even a starter, maybe even as that upside. I don't think so, but or he could just not even be in the rotation. He started in the rotation today. He was ahead of Bobby Portis, so good start for him at least. So I would say Mirotić should probably be my pick.
That's a good call. Mirotić probably would have been second on my list, just because I think he has more potential to reach his ceiling than somebody like Tony Snell.
All right, this is a good one to end on here that I'm going to really enjoy doing, and I think you will too. Jeff Swizzle. If every player on every team was in their prime, no matter the age currently, which current roster would be the best? Now, I'm guessing that the constructs of Jeff's question was, all right, they've got all these old guys, you bring them back to your prime. But technically, being a lawyer, I can point this out, that we could also fast forward young guys into their primes too. So let's look at it from two ways. Let's start with just the old guys going back in time. Who stands out to you?
So there were four teams in that end, and they're actually my top four just because the young guys accelerating, it's so hard to determine. My top four, so I'll go 4-1. Four, the Clippers, because the Clippers get a lot of guys just ratcheted up, and then they also fix their biggest hole by having a prime Paul Pierce, so that really helps them a lot. Their bench gets filthy because you get guys like Brandon Bass and Jamal Crawford to their primes, and you know, who knows, maybe you roll the dice on somebody like Bryce Johnson and Diamond Stone, maybe you get something out of them. Three,
yeah, well so we're just doing the vets right now, going
yeah back. These are the vets.
Yeah.
Three, the Spurs. You could make a very good argument that they would start five, that they could start five Hall of Famers. They'd probably have Manu coming off the bench because of the pop. But Tony Parker, Kawhi, LaMarcus, Powell, you know, they would have been better last year with Duncan. But the reason they're lower than some of the other teams is just because I still worry about their overall defense. But they would be a great team, and they have a lot of deep guys. And you also have some dice rolls with the young guys too. Number two is Cleveland. Prime LeBron puts them to a whole nother degree. We don't know what prime Kyrie is yet. And some of their older guys like Richard Jefferson, Birdman, Dunleavy, you get a better bench that way. And for me, number one is the Warriors, because the Warriors have two MVPs. You get the best out of them. You get prime Draymond, but also you get prime Andre Iguodala, which is huge. You get David West, Sean Livingston. I would be an interesting conversation for what prime Sean Livingston was, how we're counting that. But, you know, I think the Warriors
still wouldn't have a center. I mean, it would be prime JaVale McGee would be their center. Like, they would have
Their center would be Draymond. They would, can you imagine the death lineup with all those guys in their primes?
I mean, yeah, or maybe they would just have, David West or, let's see. I think the Spurs would be better than that Cleveland team. Although, God, like absolute prime LeBron. I mean, because Love and Kyrie aren't really that much better than they are right now. And just some of those bench guys like aren't moving the needle when we're talking about just how loaded some of these teams would be. I mean, you're talking about prime Parker, prime Manu, prime Gasol, who is actually pretty good on defense.
Prime
still
Kawhi.
At that point.
We don't even know what that is yet.
Yeah, that could be like 2 years from now, even. Like, that's crazy. Where he could get to. David Lee would be a nice bench piece, even back from his prime. They have a younger bench than they've had in the past, so that's a little bit different. Utah would be an interesting one.
Yeah, they're more of one of those a little bit on the younger teams that'll get better. But yeah, I mean, you add Joe Johnson, Boris Diaw, whatever you want to say is George Hill's prime.
They might be the deepest one of maybe all these teams. I got another one for you that you're totally forgetting about, the New York Knicks.
I did think of the Knicks, but I mean, really, those best Bulls teams never even made the NBA Finals. So, I mean, yeah, you get Melo. Right,
so you would have Defensive Player of the Year, Noah.
Yeah.
You're going to fast forward Porzingis. You've got Carmelo as like a great player in like 2013, 2014. Derrick Rose, MVP level guy. Courtney Lee as a good guy off the bench. Like, that would be a pretty damn good team. And even
they're
Bulls,
not better
too
than the Spurs, though. Would you have? I think they weren't a consideration, but they're not in that top three.
What about the Bulls? You giving them any love with prime Dwayne Wade?
Nope.
Rondo?
Their big man spots are still really, really weak compared to these other teams.
And Taj, I mean, you just get defense out of your bigs. Yeah, I mean, Taj Gibson, that's probably as your best big. He was pretty good back then, but you're right. I mean, their bigs probably wouldn't be able to measure.
I do want to mention, though, because I kind of glossed over them, but the Clippers just getting prime Chris Paul. I mean, Chris Paul, to me, is one of the greatest players to never win an MVP. You get that. You get whatever you want to consider prime Blake and DeAndre. But also just like their bench players, Jamal Crawford, you know, I think they would be really good too.
They probably wouldn't necessarily be in this discussion, but the Grizzlies with prime Vince Carter would be pretty sick.
I would just love to watch that team.
Yeah, that would be pretty nasty. I think you're shorting the Knicks a little bit here.
Nope. Well, I mean, Porzingis, aging him forward is exciting, but.
Well, you're just forgetting like how good Noah was defensively too. Like that would be like a pretty good team. I think like the Noah that didn't like could actually finish around the rim and like run a pick and roll. That'd be pretty solid. But yeah, I think it still would be the Warriors. And that's amazing to say, although God, man, that Clippers team would be pretty nasty. That's gotta be like number two.
I have such a belief in Prime LeBron. I mean, that's just Prime LeBron is the best player of my adult lifetime. And so, you know, you get him and Kyrie is a phenomenal talent. Like, I just feel like if you gave them, this goes along with my idea that while it wasn't for good reasons included in your discussion with Kevin Pelton of the best teams of all time, that to me, the Prime Heat, if you were to throw everybody in series, would do better than a lot of those teams that had better success just because the way the league has moved. And I feel that way with Prime LeBron. That's just like, he's a guy that you could just throw in against any of these guys and just wreck them.
I would agree with you on the Heat. If you could have taken the role players that they had in 2013 and playing small and then given us the 2011 versions of Bosch and Wade, because those guys just weren't as good in those next 2 years as they were earlier on, especially Wade. Then that obviously would have been just completely unstoppable. But I think just those teams were not that dominant. I think those are some down years.
I have a question for you. If they were eligible, where would you put last year's Heat?
So that's Wade, Dragic, Whiteside, Chris Bosh, Joe Johnson, Luol Deng. Probably not in the top four.
Winslow, like, aged forward, Tyler Johnson.
Yeah, the aged forward is no, like, I don't like that part of it. I thought it was interesting, but because it's just too hard to even know what they were.
I want to talk about two teams to age forward, though, because they're the most interesting.
The Wolves, obviously.
The Wolves and the Sixers.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I think both of those teams, just because they have a lot of high ceiling guys that are intriguing. And so you think about, oh, well, what could they be? You know, like those two are interesting. And then the other one is the possibility of the Nuggets, but they're not in the same class as the other ones, just because Simmons and Embiid and Towns and Wiggins they're a class all their own. Actually, Towns is a class all his own, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think that Spurs, Cavs, Clippers, and Warriors would be an unbelievable Final Four for this question. Although it wouldn't be a Final Four because LeBron would just roll through the East as usual, and the other teams in the West would have to beat each other up. Should we do one more here? Do we have time?
I always have time, Nate.
Said like a man recording a podcast at 1:20 a.m. Okay, let's. You want to pick this last one here? Maybe a shorter one.
Yeah. So basically, I'm not going to go through the whole structure. Actually, I'm going to do two. We're going to do one fast one. From Dan Demand 4, where would you rate Ronnie Price's contract in terms of all-time strange contracts? And I just wanted to say it that in terms of a 1 to Landry Fields, it's probably about an 8.
Yeah.
Like, because there was a clear need. Like, there was a need for a guy who could do that because every team should have 3-point guards and, you know, that there weren't a ton of options, but giving him a second guaranteed year was bonkers.
Yeah, and remember Landry Fields, he was my pick as well for being the weirdest one. The Raptors signed him as a restricted free agent, thinking that the Knicks would be forced to match and therefore would not be able to sign Steve Nash in free agency, and that Nash would then come to the Raptors instead, and then they end up just getting stuck with Fields, and he had this outlier 3-point shooting. Fields, actually, I saw him today. He's now working as a scout for the Spurs.
Good for him.
All right, what's our last one?
So the last one gets into something that I kind of actually another quick one is, do you want to define four game just quickly?
Oh yeah, it's basically everything that you're doing when the ball's not in your hands.
Yeah.
Rebounding, help defend, setting screens, those kind of things.
So this one I wanted to set up just so I could talk about this. Celtics big four asked, he phrased it in the way of, I'm assuming it's a he, of if the Celtics draft Fultz or Dennis Smith or their other young guys develop more, will the Celtics look to trade Isaiah Thomas? And I think this is such an interesting situation because for a million different reasons they should, but you have to have the guy lined up in order to do it because the Celtics have expectations now. So I do not want to be the team that signs Isaiah to his next contract, and especially if that is a team with a high ceiling as Boston hopes to be. But you can't trade him unless you're getting somebody in return because the bottom falls out of this team, and you never do that with somebody who could be the second best team in a conference because you might be, you know, kissing a title goodbye, and there's not enough of a reason to do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Isaiah's trade value is high enough that it's really worth losing a season or two of him for them at this point, when, as you said, it could be difficult to replace him. He's a key cog for them. You know, if you look at, for example, a good comp would be Goran Dragic, who I want to say was like 28 when he got traded from Phoenix to the Heat. I thought that the Heat probably gave up a little bit too much to get him, although they did get his bird rights and re-sign him. I also think that Dragic's value at that time, his standing in the league, despite the fact that Thomas was an all-star, was higher. Thomas being so diminutive is just not going to age probably as well as people thought that Dragic was going to, fair or not fair. And with that being the case, you know, they got a first rounder that was 1-7 protected, and another totally unprotected one, although both of those at the time of the trade were way in the future, which of course
pushing up against the 7-year rule,
right? Which of course, though, you know, diminishes what their value is. So I mean, are you going to get even a top? You'd probably get, just because his contract is ending too, that's the other thing. If you traded him like now, or you traded him last year, yeah, you'd probably get like the two first round picks, but probably maybe like top 10 protected or something.
More like what the Cavs gave up for Mozgov.
Yeah, that's a pretty decent counter too. And remember, though, they were also totally desperate to get somebody like Isaiah Thomas. He's probably not going to go to a team that where he's going to make the difference for them winning a championship. There just aren't that many teams out there, and those teams aren't going to have the assets to send back to the Celtics.
And the Magic just don't have that many more things to trade anymore now that they already did it for Serge Ibaka.
Oh, yeah. So I don't think that he, if you had to guess, unless they find some other point guard solution, I'm going to say he is not going to get traded between now and the end of his contract.
And also, if assuming that the guy who supplants him is a young guy, even if you draft Markelle Fultz, you still want to see how that works out considering their expectations. You
can't roll with Fultz or Dennis Smith, or you know, you're just, he's not gonna be good enough, and they're gonna be trying to win 50 games or more next year as well.
The most likely way for me that he doesn't stay on this team is if they make a trade for a star and that team would want him. And incidentally, two of the teams, actually maybe even three of the teams that could be trading star level players would be teams that actually have a need. So if OKC traded Russ, if Chicago traded Jimmy Butler, or if Sacramento traded DeMarcus Cousins, all three of those teams could use him as kind of a throw-in. He wouldn't be the centerpiece of those deals, and that would be the way that you trade him. But he's not going to be the, you know, the guy who brings that back.
We actually can do one more because this is an easy one. I wrote out the answer to it, so we might as well give the people a little added value here. MM825, which playoff teams or expected playoff teams would miss the playoffs if their best player missed 35 games?
Can I give my answer because it's very quick?
Yeah.
Everyone but the Warriors, the Cavs, the Spurs, and the Celtics. Everyone.
The Spurs would be okay.
Actually, the Celtics would probably be okay too, just if we're assuming it's Isaiah.
But you said the Celtics would be okay, right?
Yeah, but then I'm thinking about it, and I was like, they would fall out. I think they'd still make it. They'd be like...
Their defense would actually probably improve.
Yeah.
Like, they'd have a top five defense. They could go...
They'd be a rock fight team. They'd do okay.
Yeah, they would probably be like a 30, high 30s win team without Isaiah Thomas, with just his backups in there. So yeah, I mean, because you're thinking about, all right, how many wins is it going to cost you? Well, what type of ball are you going to play over those 35 games? So I'm trying to think of, it really probably would be everyone other than those teams that you named. I think you're right about that.
And that's a testament also to just how deep those top teams are, that, you know, that they can do that, because losing your best player for 35 games is a lot, you know, like that's a long time. And, you know, there are teams, like, you could argue Utah could maybe do it just because they have enough other dudes to get like the 8th seed. But at the same point, they haven't proven
it. Oh, yeah. Utah would make it. Yeah, they would do it. I think they lost Gordon Hayward. Yeah. Or Gobert or Favors. Yeah, I think whoever you want to say of those guys is their best. Yeah, I think they'd still be a playoff team. They just have so much depth.
What team do you think, good or bad, would have the biggest drop off, whether that makes them the playoff team or not, with losing?
Oh, the Clippers. Player? Did you say the Clippers? Clippers would make it.
I don't think they would.
They've done it. Like, Paul and Griffin Griffin missed a bunch. I mean, I guess it's Paul, but like, when Paul missed like 20 games, they still were over 500 2 years ago.
Yeah, they played a lot of weak teams during that stretch. You could certainly make an argument. I would disagree with it, but I think. But,
I mean, would they?
Oh yeah, but that's true. But you still get Chris Paul. We're assuming. I mean, you could also make the assumption that he could be injured for more games. I mean, are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm saying 35 games exactly.
Okay, so then then they would still make it, because they would also be like a, you know, probably like a 55-60 win pace for the other part. So yeah.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what you got to remember is like for 35 games, if they're playing at a 55 win pace over 35 games, I don't know exactly what that would work out to, but it's probably like, you know, 22 or 23 wins. And then, so it's probably costing you, and then you play 500 without, so it's, that's probably costing you like 7 wins.
So then by that logic, should the Raptors make it?
Yeah, I think they would still be okay.
Yeah. So then really what it is it's before that kind of morass, because all the teams in the morass, like 6 or 7 wins just knocks you below all of them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one of the things that's important to remember here too is when you're talking about a short amount of the season, this is the same concept as why this whole thing of like, oh, being in the East or the West doesn't actually cost you that many wins, because 59 of your games are the same, right? And this, you know, we're talking about, yeah, you're playing much worse, but it's only over 35 games. There's only so many games that can kill you on if you're still the difference between, like, you know, being 500 and a 50 win team over a third of the season like that, or maybe a little bit more. It isn't as many games as you think it actually is. You know, that's 5-6 games, and those, a lot of these teams have an effort cushion.
Good point.
All right, now we're done here. You got anything to plug before we go?
After tomorrow's Warriors game, I will have, well, I did a new Locked On Warriors about kind of schedule analysis thing, and then I'm going to have 2 new pieces and a podcast after the game against the Pelicans.
Excellent. I have not written anything new other than this podcast and other than the things that I plugged already. So follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I'll be watching some games tomorrow if you want to follow along with the live tweeting, and we'll be back.
Oh, I'll mention one yes. small thing, because people thought it was cool. I did a few videos for Yard Barker. I was in there. I'm friends with Ed Maisonette. And so for people who want to see that I actually have an arm, I have arms and legs, that was apparently exciting. So you can, those will be on my timeline.
Much thinner arms and legs than you used to, thanks to the naked 3D fitness tracker and your own incredible discipline, of course.
Of course.
All right. So anyway, yeah, follow Danny at Danny LaRue. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. And we'll be back on Sunday night. Talk to you all later.